This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 Chai FM.
101.9 Chai FM. My name is Dylan Berger, and welcome to this week's edition of The Deep Dive. It is a slightly different edition this week. It is still with Brooke Spector, but he's on the other end of the microphone and other end of the table. Good morning, Brooks. How are you doing today?
Well, good morning. This is unusual. I'm happy to do it, to give insights, to give thoughts, to give observations, probably to provoke fan mail or screaming complaints, but, you know, whatever works out.
Well, Brooks, you know, it's an absolute pleasure to have you. And, you know, if you look at the calendar, you'll see that this Saturday is the 4th of July. And it's not just any 4th of July celebration. It's the 250th anniversary of the United States independence. And we're going to be taking a deep dive, excuse the pun, into that. And what does that mean? And, you know, how significant that is in today's age and modern times. And it's fantastic to be speaking to you because, Brooke Spector, you are a former and a veteran U.S. diplomat, both in Africa and East Asia. You're a political analyst. You're also a founding associate editor of the Daily Maverick newspaper. So you know a thing or two when it comes to politics and the United States of America. So maybe we can just kick off and take us back 250 years ago. I wasn't born yet, and I don't think you were either. But there were some very famous men. Some of their pictures are on money in America and the dollar bills, and they did something quite significant. If you can set the tone, you know, give us a little bit of an insight of what these gentlemen were doing.
Of course, it's good to be with you. Let me do it this way: 250 years ago. A gathering of 50 or so people from the then 13 colonies. Those were largely settled by people from Great Britain on the North American continent, on the eastern coast, as part of the larger European expansion into the New World. Although they were British in origin for the most part, and although they felt an allegiance to the British imperial system, there was a growing sense that Britain's interests and theirs had become different.
Interesting.
And
okay.
This largely came about because the British, in an attempt to impose a series of relatively small taxes on things like tea and official documents, to pay for what in America is called the French and Indian War and what the rest of the world called the 7 Years War, which was largely France versus Britain, France, Spain, and a few other countries versus Britain. The British side was victorious, but the colonies felt that it wasn't fair to ask them to pay for Britain's imperial reach. And this began to push the population further away from their ancestral origins and their roots. And by the year 1776, there had already been some fighting. There had been several pitched battles, actually, between colonial militias and British troops sent largely to enforce British rule. And these men were drawn from the I don't want to use the word aristocracy precisely, right, but the elite of the colonies,
okay,
people who were in large part well-educated, in large part professional men or successful farmers, or people who felt that their role in life was to lead rather than simply to, you know, to follow. They were the ones who were well-educated were truly were for their time. They had read the Greek philosophers. They had read Rousseau. They had read Voltaire.
Like Benjamin Franklin you're referring to?
That's great. Benjamin Franklin is a fascinating case because he was really a self-made man.
Sure.
He came from a very poor background. He showed up in the then small city of Philadelphia with a couple of pennies to his name.
Wow.
establish himself as a printer, which was a wow, important profession. Basically created the first public library in the colonies, first free public library. He invented the postal system for America before stamps, that is.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
And he wrote and published something called Poor Richard's Almanac. And an almanac in those days wasn't simply a question of giving you the information about the tides or the lunar cycles or basic meteorological data that might be at hand. It was a compendium of ideas and thoughts and wisdom and popular sayings and clever jokes. And it came out every year, and it was probably the first bestseller in North America. And it ran for decades. And he was one of those people who began to believe that the colonies had created, quote unquote, a new man, as opposed to an Englishman.
Oh, okay, interesting. Interesting.
By virtue of immigration and new circumstances and the blending of people from different backgrounds, there had been created a population that was significantly different from their British forebears, that they deserved to become their own country. And this was a fairly heretical idea if you were living in London, that a colony would decide on its own to simply go a different path. And so he and John Adams, who was a particularly a cantankerous lawyer from Boston, he was willing, for example, to take the side, to take the charge of defending British soldiers who had assaulted or shot Americans in a riot in 1773. And Adams and Franklin and one other person, but most importantly, Thomas Jefferson, who was a Virginia planter and who had, he was one of the first polymaths, really, that we can think about in a modern sense. You know, he mastered architecture and learning. He played the violin. He spoke French.
Interesting. I think I did read that. Funny enough, I came up with my research. He did say that he was a French speaker.
And he wrote, in large part, the Declaration of Independence, which was a cannon shot across the sky. Especially, you know, right at the top, you know, we hold these truths that men are created equal and they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. This is the kind of phraseology you did not hear in British society or the Parliament of its time.
Sure.
Now, one of the real ironies, of course, is that Thomas Jefferson was a slaveholder, as were many of the rich in the South. And in his original draft of the Declaration of Independence, there was a phrase that he had put in about the way in which the British government had perpetuated and supported the slave trade. And it was taken out of his draft. Now, keep in mind, back at home, Thomas Jefferson has hundreds of people in indentured servitude handling his fields and his cattle and, you know, building his house for him. But what he did do in this question of slavery, no slavery, to create one of the defining fights of American society from the moment of independence straight through to the Civil War 80-odd years later, Jefferson himself had written that the perpetuation of slavery was like a fire bell into the night. In other words, that this was something that you couldn't avoid. This was something that had to be dealt with, but the way in which it was going to be dealt with was postponed.
So I'm going to ask you just to hold that thought for a few seconds. We are going to cut to a break, and then after the break, we are going to pick up on that.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
Wow, 101.9 Chai FM. Welcome back to this week's edition of The Deep Dive. I am in discussion and conversation with Brooke Spector, and we are speaking about the 250th anniversary of the U.S. U.S. independence, which is taking place this coming weekend on the 4th of July. Now, Brooks, I wanted to ask you, you know, from an outsider looking in, you know, if you had asked me as a 10-year-old Dillenberger, what date is the U.S. Independence Day? I would tell you it's the 4th of July. If you had asked me at 10 years old, what date is my parents' wedding anniversary? I would probably say to you, I have absolutely no idea. And, you know, for my whole life, I've always seen, you know, the fireworks on the 4th of July and the hot dogs and the barbecues and the, you know, just the celebration and people, you know, planning their weeks in advance what they're going to be doing. And I've always kind of wondered, what are they celebrating? What is the celebration all about?
That's a wonderful question. It really is. And it's important, too, because we love that the United States was founded uniquely. The United States was founded on an idea rather than a geographical truth or an ethnic truth or a religious truth, in the sense that the idea that we cited earlier in the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal and they have certain inalienable rights, etc., was the foundational ideology for the country. If you look at the world in toto, arguably there is no other country that is based on an idea rather than a geographical circumstance, a history, an ethnicity. You could make an argument, I think, and I guess for the audience for this station, perhaps it's important to mention that you could argue that the modern state of Israel also is based on an idea.
True. Very good
but
point.
It is also preeminently rooted in a geographical sense, and arguably an ethnic one as well. America is a little different in that regard, in that the idea was that whoever showed up in America, with a footnote, of course, whoever showed up was entitled to the virtues of the citizenship of this new idea, this new place, this new republic. And that footnote, of course, is, as we were mentioning just before the break, slavery, which was a feature of most societies in the world, but was the one that was almost certain to tear the country apart less than 100 years after its founding. So when people say they are celebrating the 4th of July, they are not celebrating, I like to put it this way. There are two sacred secular holidays in America.
4th of July?
One is the 4th of July, the founding of the country, and the other is Thanksgiving.
That was going to be my guess.
and the reason, the curious part about it is that it celebrates a dissident Protestant sect who pitched up in Massachusetts to escape the Anglican society of England. Now, of course, they were theocratic in their circumstances, and they didn't allow anybody else to think differently. But the mythology that grew up around it was a bunch of hardy religious pioneers desperate to pursue their religious values despite the vicissitudes of their new existence. And they were helped by friendly Native Americans to learn how to grow corn and catch turkeys and generally enjoy life better than they would have been persecuted in Restoration England. And those two ideas really animate most Americans, or did for a very long time, in the sense that we understood that the country was created out of a new way of thinking, and that it welcomed various versions of yourself. And a French writer, Crevecoeur, came to the U.S. in the 1780s, just after the country was formed, in his book, Letters from an American Farmer, and he described America as the creation of a new man, one with principles and ideas and values that were significantly different than the old order of Europe, with a very rigid hierarchy and social values.
So, Brooks, let me ask you, you brought up a very interesting point about America being founded on an idea. And, you know, for my whole life, I've heard about the American dream and about how being America is the beacon of democracy and civil rights. Now, I wonder, and I'm going to, apologies if this is a very difficult question, but does this still resonate today in the U.S., internationally? Does this idea of this, what America was founded on, is it still burning as bright as it was a century ago, maybe a century and a half ago? Or has it? Does it need to be kind of reignited?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. And it quite clearly, there is a deep debate in the United States about what the soul of the country really is. Yeah. And this is taking a political form, it's taking an economic form, and it's taking a social form as well. After World War II, when the United States, largely unscathed by the war, but significantly part of the winning coalition to defeat Nazi Germany, fascist Italy, and Imperial Japan, the country had, I'm going to guess because I didn't look this up, something like 50% of the global productivity, industrial productivity, was in the U.S. Of course, much of Europe had been flattened, and Japan had been destroyed as an economic entity in many ways, and even victorious Britain and Soviet Union were deeply scarred by the war. But the assumption that the way forward was that American dream you're talking about had a powerful influence on society in the U.S. It was aspirational. It wasn't as if everybody was suddenly going to have two cars in their garage, a really huge roast or a chicken on Sunday afternoon for lunch, a home, send their kids to college and a whole bit. But everybody presumably aspired to that sense. And that was a contagious idea that was carried around the world, partly through the movies, partly through literature, partly through when television came to other societies. South Africa was late to getting television, of course.
Sure, in the
70s. Television arrived in South Africa in 1976, which was sort of long after the that American dream was there. Now, large numbers of people were left out, obviously, if you were an African-American.
Right.
You may aspire to that, but
it was a long shot.
The circumstances of politics meant it was a serious bank shot to get to that American dream. What's interesting about it, too, and I did some research on this once, many different countries in their foundational document, in one way or another, either directly or indirectly quoted the Thomas Jefferson line in the Declaration of Independence.
Interesting.
Of all places in the world, in Vietnam, in the Declaration of Independence written by Ho Chi Minh,
wow,
he quoted Thomas Jefferson in his initial declaration. And this is fairly common. But the founders of the country, they weren't quite as starry-eyed as that. They had read their Plato. They had looked at all the societies of Europe they could find information about, and they were deeply worried that if they did not create a monarchy, if they created a democracy that is ruled by the people from the Greek, it would inevitably decay into what Plato would have called a mob. That governance would be in the hands of a strong man and a bunch of people waving spears or scythes or something and butchering their opponents. And as a result, 15 years later, when they created the government, largely the same people, by the way, they're just older and a little bit more aware of things. They reconvened to write a constitution after discovering that simply by declaring independence from Britain wasn't exactly the end of the problem. they created a government which was in which the powers were divided among a judiciary, an executive, and a parliament, as well as some powers that were shared among them. And Ben Franklin, who by now was in his 80s and was not quite as spry as he would have been, was asked by one of his friends, as the story goes, "What have we created in this?" And he looked at his inquisitor and interrogator, and he said, "We have created a republic, if you can keep it."
Interesting.
And they were aware of the fact that, you know, this was an experiment and it might well fail.
Brooks, I'm going to ask you just to hold that thought for a second. We are going to cross to a quick break, and then we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooks Spector.
High FM, welcome back. You are listening to The Deep Dive. It is hosted today by myself, Dylan Berger, and I am in conversation with Brooks Spector, and we are speaking about the 250th anniversary of the U.S. independence. And as you would know, that this coming weekend is the 4th of July. For those who are celebrating, congratulations, Mazel Tov. What is the appropriate, appropriate message to give to Americans, Brooks?
Most of the people, I guess, would probably not say Mazel Tov. Most people would probably. Some might, you know, you never know. If you were to have read Frederick Douglass, who was an African-American escapee from slavery.
Of course I have. But...
Well, I mean, his autobiography is short, but really well worth reading. It's one of the consummate documents, how someone reconstitutes their life after, you know, the horrors of being a slave on a plantation in Eastern Maryland. He had a famous speech and essay in which he questioned the idea, what does the 4th of July mean to an enslaved American or a black American? What does it really mean if you're in a personal state of being owned by another person? Mm. That dream that's in the Declaration of Independence, that is seriously not achievable. But he softened this by saying it's possible, but not yet.
So I'm
not going to get there yet.
I wanted to quickly ask, you know, if we have to look back on the last 250 years, what can America be proud of? I mean, a lot has happened, a lot hasn't happened, but a lot has happened. What are the key takeaways that Americans and America as a nation can be proud of over the last two centuries and a half?
Yeah, I would like to point to a couple of things. And first, we're gonna enter demography.
Okay.
The study of population. Between 1880 and 1920, roughly the period when commercial steamship lines were carrying people across the Atlantic on regularly scheduled journeys, something on the order of 20 million people fled Europe.
Wow.
To the United States. Why? Because when you think about somebody who immigrates, so an immigrant, a refugee, there are two causes. There's a push.
Yeah, and there's a pull.
You're being chased by people who are out ready to kill you on the basis of your race, religion, color,
sure,
creed, or, you know, political views. And you're being pulled. You're being pulled by the thought that there is another place that
days
will be better for you.
Yeah.
There's an opportunity. And you see that, for example, in the very last moments of the Broadway show Fiddler on the Roof, which is about as poignant an evocation of that idea. What happens to one of the daughters and her lover or husband? I can't remember what happened, whether they're married yet. Where are they going? They're fleeing from their little town in Tsarist Russia.
Mm.
They're fleeing to America.
Sure.
And that's what happens. People came in their millions from the Tsarist Empire, from Austro-Hungary, from Germany, from the Balkans, from Italy,
Ireland,
a little bit less from Britain, also from Norway, Sweden, Finland. And they went to the United States in an effort to better themselves and not be killed by their opponents.
True.
Now, the Chinese migrants across the Pacific their fate was less easy to take on board. But what did they call America? What was their phrase in Chinese, Chinese, the Gold Mountain?
But what were they alluding to?
Well, they were saying that if you leave the famine-stricken farms of China, this is an opportunity to reap benefits, to come out ahead, to change your life, to achieve riches.
You've touched on the one aspect of people bettering their lives by coming to the United States. What else can America take away as huge positives over the last few centuries? I mean, obviously, we look at the technology, the culture. I mean, I know my little daughter, there's a T-shirt she has and there's a flag of the United States of America on it. And she's always excited to wear it because she thinks to herself, wow, America's this wonderful, great place. And she wants to go there one day and she sees things on TV. So, I mean, is that still the feeling? Are we still there?
Well, let me give you a story. Years ago, I was on a hike through a natural national park in Indonesia and in Western Java. Wow. On the mythic search for the Javan tiger. Of course, we never saw one, and I have no idea what we would have done if we had encountered it.
Good thing you did it.
That would have been the wrong answer, right? But we get to an outcropping of rock on a hillside, and painted on one of the rocks at the top of the heap of rocks in big, big white letters was one word, Kojak.
Kojak.
Kojak, a television program from the United States that was enormously popular in America and around the world, starring Telly Savalas. And he was a policeman, and he was notable for his bald head and his willingness to always having a lollipop in his mouth.
Okay.
But why in the world, in the middle of the jungle in Java, is somebody saying Kojak? And what this told me was the absolute ubiquitousness of American popular culture in its good as well as its less good forms. That it was it's inescapable. You couldn't avoid it. Everywhere you looked, whether it was television, whether it was novels, whether it was film, whether it was music, the American culture was generating or spewing out this deluge of material and ideas and thoughts, sometimes in huge conflict with one another. And the fact that people everywhere wanted a part of it. They wanted a piece of it. If you go back to this country among its black populations in the 1940s and early 1950s, people wanted to dress in the style that they assumed to be the American flashy dresser,
right.
Sometimes maybe a gangster, but sometimes, but definitely a flashy style America.
Sure,
it was
sure.
called, and you know, this stuff was everywhere. It still is, to some degree. Of course, people now argue that is in fact the curse of America rather than the blessing.
How so?
It snuffs out all the other local ideas, thoughts, culture, and information, that it's just so overpowering that nothing else can survive. And there's always that tension, I guess, in a country that is so productive that it generates this kind of thing. Back in the 1830s, some British woman famously had said, America, who reads an American book? And you know, her sort of snarky answer was, nobody of any consequence would bother. And that was, now if you were to answer that now, the answer would basically be everybody.
So let me ask you, if you had to look at where we are currently in today's world, what worries you about where America is today compared to the ideas and the concepts that it was founded on? What has it gone astray? How can it come back to where it needs to be? What are your biggest worries where we're currently sitting?
My biggest fear is that the kind of downward thrusting politics, the angry populism that the incumbent president has come to embody is going to become the norm. It's not something that will change. It'll be something that becomes what is the norm, that it will be the thing that motivates people into the future. And that would argue for a serious increase in social, political, and economic conflict. And I think you see some of the response to that in this rise in the new wave of democratic socialism. Candidates like Zoran Mdani, the new mayor of New York City, sure, and several Democratic nominees for Congress that are his people in states beyond New York City now. That's a response to the kind of avaricious, I can take what I want, I can do what I want, I don't have to worry about the law or anybody else, that seems to embody the current president and his followers. And they are also animated by a different feeling at the same time, which is that the elites don't care about them, and so therefore they have to put their trust in some guy who leads them in the front with the flag and so forth.
I'm going to ask you just to hold that thought for a couple of minutes. We're all going to cross to a quick break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Thank you so much.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
Chai FM, you are listening to this week's edition of The Deep Dive. It is hosted this week by myself, Dylan Berger, and I am joined on the other end of the table, or under the other end of the microphone, by Brooke Spector, a veteran U.S. diplomat for Africa, East Africa, also a political analyst, founding associated editor of The Daily Maverick. Brooks, I've been thoroughly enjoying this conversation, and we are chatting about the 4th of July, which is coming up this weekend, and America's 250th anniversary of their independence. I often think, is 250 years a long time, or is America but a puppy? It's guide me on this one. I can't work it out. Is America a young nation? Is America actually now a veteran? Are they like the you tell me.
Well, I mean, there's the famous quote, and I'm struggling to remember whether it was Mao Zedong or Chou En Lai, or maybe it was Mahatma Gandhi, for all I know. And he was asked, what do you think about the Western civilization? And he said, it's still too early to tell. the idea is that the time perspective, if you are a society which has been around for thousands of years, if not necessarily the same government, and the society obviously has changed over time, your time perspective is rather different than a place which measures its success over a quarter of a millennium. By the same token, though, any number of societies that achieved a more representative style of government or threw off the shackles of a dictator or a monarchy, many of them fell by the wayside in fairly short order. And one of the things that I was alluding to when we talked about the founders, when they were trying to figure out what a kind of a government they were going to create. I mean, sure, they had a bunch of clay in front of them, basically, and no idea what they were going to make out of it. They looked at all of the examples they could find of republics, classical Athens, right, Republican Rome, Venice, the Dutch Republic, Genoa, not so, maybe a little bit. But those were about all the examples they could come up with, and in each case, they could look to the fact that the society that they were looking at, the version of rule that they were looking at, had failed. Athens ended up in a
sure
in a suicide, essentially a suicidal war.
Interesting, very interesting.
With Sparta, eventually under the guidance of an autocratic populist. Rome, of course, we all know, ceased being a republic with the advent of Augustus. Venice decayed into a sort of a fake kind of republic. And the Dutch ended up adopting, after the Napoleonic interlude, they ended up adopting a monarchy again. So the founders were perplexed about what they should make. More recently, former President Joe Biden was quoted when someone asked him, will the country survive? Will it succeed despite its current problems? And Biden said, never bet against America. If we were sitting here in 1975, okay.
Just before 51 years ago,
the United States had faced a devastating defeat in the Vietnam conflict.
Right.
Terrible embarrassment, terrible death, terrible destruction. A million, perhaps, Vietnamese had died in that struggle. Almost 60,000 Americans had died. It was in what was ultimately, without question, a failed policy.
Sure.
And the country was in large part in the midst of an ongoing civil rights revolution, whether it was by race or whether it was by gender. Deep anxiety about whether the country would manage to pull itself together and become whole, successful, prosperous. There was also a recession. So, I mean, you know, all the things mitigating against success were there in front of you. By 1990, its main antagonist in the world had disintegrated. Soviet Union didn't exist anymore. We had 15 separate countries. In the popular imagination, you could argue that that proved without doubt the success of the American model.
Interesting.
And the supremacy of the American economy and government and society. But what it also showed was the ability of the country, I think, to regenerate, to rebuild itself, to come out of a period of decline and difficulty into one that was preeminent in its way globally. You can argue, I think, now that we are, as a country, looking at a similar kind of difficulty.
I was about to allude to that.
Well, I mean, the parallels are extraordinary. The country is now faced with the realization that for whatever its reasons, this war of choice in Iran, and I'm sure some listeners will disagree with me on that, that whatever its reasons for it, it showed, A, the limitations on American power.
Right.
All it takes is a couple of guys dressed in, you know, in fatigues or a kaftan with a missile to close off the single most important strategic waterway in the world, perhaps.
Gotcha.
And the United States appears to be unable to stop that. And that is provoking a sense of argument, discussion, and debate about national purpose.
So let me ask you, I see that you're wearing a hat, and I'm going to ask you to take off that hat and put on your Notre Dame's hat for a few seconds.
I always wear a hat.
But I'm asking you to change the hat for a few seconds just to possibly shed some light as to what do the next 250 years look like? What is in store? What is going to change? What are some of the challenges that America is going to face in the next? I mean, obviously, we can't go too far. We don't know what's all going to be in store. But what can we potentially be looking out for?
What was that song a few years back in the year 2025? What will man survive?
I know which one you're referring to.
I can't remember the rest of the lyrics, but never mind. Maybe you can find it somewhere in a music
library. I'm going to have to know.
Yeah, you'll have to sort of play it in the background slightly. Look, we are all now globally faced with the question of what version of humanity we are going to be as we encounter the new world of artificial generative intelligence.
True.
And the technologies associated with it. But the way in which that's going to integrate itself with human behavior,
gotcha.
And human choices and human activities. There are predictions that any number of professions and activities will simply vanish because this new species of electronics will simply make it necessary. And we already see that in newsrooms around the world, vast chunks of what we read or listen to is generated by something other than a human being pounding away at a keyboard.
Very true. Have to admit that.
There is a question about whether or not new technologies or old ones or old challenges are going to make universal abundance possible. Will we finally be unshackled from the need, to engage constantly to earn enough, to make enough, to so that we can survive. And on the other side of that is, of course, the question of we will need to survive. Will we have to take apart the earth sufficiently to get a hold of those materials necessary that we will have created a world we don't really want to live in?
I'm going to ask you just to hold that thought for a few seconds. We are going to cut to a break, and then after break, we are going to pick up on that.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
One hundred 1.9 High FM. Welcome back. You have been listening to The Deep Dive. This week it is with myself, Dylan Berger, and I have been speaking with Brooke Spector, and we have been chatting about the 250th anniversary of the United States independence and the 4th of July that's coming up this weekend. Brooks, it's been a fantastic conversation. I really, really enjoyed it. And thank you so much for your input and your expertise. I wanted to ask you, before we wrap up, if we had to go back in time and chat to the founding fathers, the likes of John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, and ask them, you know, what do they think, how America turned out today? What would they tell us?
Interesting question. I mean, you know, obviously we're going to have to read into what they said about their time and how they would think about what they see in front of us now. But let's take them this way. Ben Franklin, the inventor, tinkerer, and inventor and creator, he would be pleased in many ways. He would look at your laptop computer and that strange thing, the mouse. And he would really, really want to know how it worked. He'd want you to give him a full tutorial. And he would be thinking all the time about how he could put it to use. Because this is, after all, the man who captured electricity from lightning in an experiment that could well have killed him, but on the other hand, made him famous. And he would be pleased that the mass media still exists. Even if it is under threat in many different ways, technologically and politically in many cases. Thomas Jefferson, he would be disappointed in some respects because he envisioned a country of sturdy, industrious yeoman farmers who read Plato at night by candlelight and debated the possibilities of a better man. But he would reluctantly, I think, be happy to learn that slavery had been abolished and that there had been progress thereafter in creating a nation that assimilated people of color, even if the journey was not finished. He might wonder a little bit about feminism because he was not a feminist.
I did not know that.
On the other hand, so few people in the 18th century were, I guess. John Adams would be, he was the first vice president. He was the second president. He was an enormously irascible man if you read his diaries and his letters, but he would be pleased that the judicial system stood its ground and that it was able to cope with challenges from politicians of all stripes over the years. James Madison is the man who wrote the Constitution in large part and created that and formalized the division of executive, judiciary, and legislature. He also said that this was necessary to have all these checks and balances because, famously, if all men were angels, there would be no need for governments. And so he was acutely aware of the idea that it wasn't the institutions, but it was also the people who inhabited them. George Washington would be something of an enigma. I mean, he was a curiosity in a way. Once the Revolutionary War was over, he put down his sword, he resigned commission, went back to being a farmer.
Yeah.
Lots of people thought of him as the contemporary version of the Roman hero Cincinnatus, who, having defeated his enemies, returned to being a farmer. He was called back to service as president and declined to allow consideration of him being referred to as a king. Wow. He And the terminology that was used, he didn't even want them to call him His Excellency, the President. He simply wanted to be called President Washington.
Interesting. I didn't know that. That's fascinating. So I have to ask you, just before we wrap up, when you listen to CNN and other stations, and they interview Congress people and they interview senators, they'll ask the question, what are you doing to celebrate the 4th of July weekend? And people share what they're going to be doing, celebrating with their families, and they're going away. I have to ask you, what are you doing to celebrate?
Well, I already did, in effect, my formal celebration. The U.S. Embassy had its 250th anniversary party on Wednesday, the 1st of July, which should have been on the 4th, but, it's a weekend. People, maybe they need their time off. They could have had it on the 2nd, which was when the vote for the independence actually took place.
Interesting.
On the 4th, they formalized it by signing it, that piece of paper. So I went to Pretoria to join in the embassy's party. They had about 600 or 700 people, the new ambassador. They had a minister from the South African government giving remarks. Former President Thabo Mbeki showed up and gave remarks as well. Something I don't think many people expected. It's in the middle of the day, so you couldn't have fireworks, but I did have a hot dog.
I was about to ask. I'm so glad that you had. I don't know if you had a Budweiser beer as well, but if you do, then we maybe have time this weekend to have one as well. Brooke Spector, that has been a fantastic, fantastic conversation. Thank you for literally giving us a deep dive into America's history, what has happened in the past 250 years, what we can look forward to, what we maybe need to make sure that doesn't happen, and thank you so much for your time, your expertise. You're a great friend of this radio station, and we look forward to speaking to you next week. We'll be back to normal. You'll be on this side of the microphone. We'll be the deep dive with Brooke Spector, not with Dylan Berger, but it's been my pleasure speaking to you, and I hope we have a great weekend.